Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Face Stuff. Face Stuff's an all-natural zinc-based product company from San Diego, California, that uses ingredients that are safe for the ocean while also protecting and moisturizing your skin. So instead of soaking up nasty radiation like chemical sunscreens, Face Stuff helps your skin reflect it. I'm a big fan of Face Stuff and always have a canister on hand and ready to use. Check them out at face-stuff.com and use promo code STOKED15 for 15% off their incredible products. Joining me today from New Zealand is environmental scientist Ed Atkin. Ed works as a consultant for eCoast Marine Consulting and Research, where he conducts research in the areas of surf science and surfing resource management. For today's episode, we'll be chatting about his doctoral dissertation, which he titled, The Development of Tools and Guidelines for Surfing Resource Management. We'll also be talking about his involvement with the Aotearoa New Zealand Association for Surfing Research and the International Association of Surfing Researchers, organizations that he's been passionately involved with for quite a while. I'm super stoked to have you on to share your insight and expertise with our listeners. Ed and I met at the Global Wave Conference in Gold Coast, Australia in 2020 and have been friends and colleagues ever since. That said, before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Ed, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Stoked to be on the podcast. It's been a while in the making, and I've been following it for a while. It's super cool to see such an eclectic mix of different researchers, I suppose, and always some really good content. So happy I got invited to come share today.
Oh yeah, Ed, absolutely. No, I'm stoked to finally coordinate with you. You know, you're on the other side of the planet, so. But super stoked to have you on. It is a really cool eclectic group, and you know, I'm looking forward to chatting with you more about your work with all of us as surf researchers as well. But before we, you know, kind of dig into that, I in the intro I say, you know, Aotearoa, New Zealand. And can you explain to our listeners, you know, I hear you say when we hang out ANZ or ANZ. So can you help myself and the listeners give us a little bit of background as to why you call it that?
Yeah. Okay. New Zealand, for those that don't know, is a small, country in, the Southwest Pacific, across the ditch from Australia. And New Zealand, the New Zealand part of Aotearoa, New Zealand, is essentially the colonial name. It's Zeeland is Dutch. No, Danish, sorry. Danish or Dutch? Danish. And it was Danish cartographers that that you know first came across the landmass from the Western world and determined that they would call it New Zealand. I think Zealand is one of the islands. And Aotearoa is the Maori name that the indigenous peoples of New Zealand. Aotearoa is their given name for the country. And Aotea or Ao is cloud. Tea is white and roa is long. So cloud, white, long. And it's a in its most basic term, and look, I'm not a te reo Maori expert, but in its most commonly interpreted sense, it's long white cloud, and that's become land of the long white cloud, and that's derived from the Polynesian explorers. When they first came across the landmass that's Aotearoa in New Zealand, the first thing that was noticed was a long white cloud because of the accumulation of water-laden air above the landmass. And the place where they first landed was a place called which they named Aotearoa, which is about 25-30 k south of here. It's it's an estuary on the west coast of New Zealand. And so why do I say Aotearoa New Zealand? Well, we live in a really diverse country, and in the field that I work in, you've got to be sort of really open and be able to approach everything and encourage people to participate as well. And some people just refer to Aotearoa as New Zealand, and some people refer to Aotearoa as Aotearoa. And so when I suppose I started putting a lot more effort into the sort of surfing resource management frame, I made some inquiries about, you know, what's the best way to sort of go about this, and the consensus from people well more informed than me was that Aotearoa New Zealand is respectful to both parties, I suppose, and it's becoming quite commonly used as well. I mean, there's an argument that it should just be Aotearoa, and I suppose there's a counter argument that it should just be New Zealand as well, but at least with Aotearoa and New Zealand, hopefully not offending any one particular party.
No, that's you know, I like I said, I remember when we were, you know, when we were in San Diego and you would call it ANZ, or you call it ANZ, but you know, I was like, why is he putting the A on there? Like, where is that coming from? And I remember asking you, and you know, explained it to me. And, you know, it's awesome. You know, it's really, I respect that and appreciate that, you know, New Zealand or Aotearoa New Zealand is making an effort to be very inclusive of, and mindful of your diversity that you all have there. And, so thanks for, you know, explaining that, you know, to me, and I'm sure many of the, listeners that aren't from your, you know, your part of the world, probably may or may not have known that. So, but you know, you mentioned, as you were talking, you mentioned surfing resource management. So I want to go ahead and dig on into your research, and your dissertation is titled The Development of Tools and Guidelines for Surfing Resource Management. And hopefully, by the way, by the time this episode airs, you will be Dr. Ed Atkin. So, I want to go ahead and maybe be the first to congratulate you. But
yeah, we got a little bit of a way to go on that.
It's all good. By all means, let's what got you into surfing resource management, and what, you know, what is this doctoral dissertation all about?
Okay, well, to answer the first part, it's essentially the surfing resource management part is a function of moving to New Zealand, and that came about through surf science, essentially. And that came about because I was studying marine engineering and marine science in the UK, and this was 20 years ago, more. And I saw, or one of my lecturers gave me the feasibility study for a multi-purpose reef at Newquay, Watergate, and Watergate Bay. And I read the feasibility study, and I was just blown away that it was someone's job to do that, to look at, you know, providing amenity value through surfing resources whilst protecting the shoreline and increasing local biodiversity. And I just was like, wow, like that's, you know, if there's one thing I'd quite like to do is work in that field, that would be so cool. You know, I kind of already made the decision that I didn't want to have to move away from the coast again for work, because, well, as a surfer, you're always thinking about just going surfing. So moving away isn't conducive to that. And where we lived in Cornwall, you know, there wasn't lots of job opportunities kind of in that kind of space anyway. So it was surf science essentially that grabbed my attention. And when I talk about surf science, I do it in a sort of very narrow sense, I suppose, in that it's more about the physical environmental setting. Now, that's not completely true these days, really, because we have sports science and physiology, and then mental health, which is medicinal science, and they all have surfing research associated with it as well. But I think, you know, a big pusher of a lot of the research into science was the engineers and the environmental scientists. And so the term surf science was kind of born out of that, but I don't think it's necessarily true these days. I think it's much broader than that. And so with the surf science, from a physical processes point of view, you learn a lot about how surf breaks function, and what makes them tick, and quantifiably what makes them good or bad, and what impacts could look like. And so through moving to NZ, where we have a management framework in place to ensure that the impacts on surf breaks are minimized or mitigated, you become exposed to a number of issues. And through one of my business partners, I was asked to provide a technical advice to a group here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, called the Surf Break Protection Society. And through multiple cases, essentially, and not just here in New Zealand, but then further afield, you start to realize that there's this whole discipline around how surf breaks or surf resources need to be managed, because it's multidisciplinary. There's lots of moving parts to it, and whilst it's essentially surfing resource management is the evolution of all the different bits and pieces associated with complete loss of surf breaks, degradation, overcrowding, you know, like the tourism impacts and things like that. And it's kind of become this, for me anyway, this overarching term for everything associated with managing these shared spaces.
It's amazing. And, you know, just for the listeners, you mentioned Cornwall, which, you know, you're originally from the UK. And as many of our listeners who are who've been listening to the podcast, episode 15 had Michael Scott Moore on, and we talked about his experience surfing in Cornwall in that area. So, but I find your work personally fascinating. You know, I'm sure you might even get tired of hearing me say that, but you know, you mention in your work, you say, it's a two-part question here, having various geophysical components in the, let me back up. Aotearoa, New Zealand, a surf break is described in policy as having various geophysical components in the vicinity of where surfing takes place and the areas offshore. So, like I said, this is kind of two parts for myself and maybe some of the listeners. What does that even mean in layman's terms? And another thing you talk about is this swell corridor. Can you just kind of help us, myself, understand what all this is referring to?
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, and I get asked this quite a lot, this whole surf break, surfing resource. In New Zealand, we have a legal instrument called the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement. And within that, and that document provides guidance to regional and local authorities on the day-to-day management of the coast that they are responsible for. And within that document, there is a policy called Policy 16, Surf Breaks of National Significance. And that policy highlights 17 surf breaks that are explicitly protected within New Zealand. But there's lots of other policies within the NZCPS, the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement, that acknowledge surf breaks as features on the coastline that are significant. And so we've got this sort of management setting for surf breaks. We have acknowledgement within a policy instrument. And so the reason why I refer to surfing resources, or why it came about, so prior to a lot of this work, surfing resource had not been used all that much, but it had been used a bit. And, you know, I dived into it. I didn't want to sort of make too many claims and whatnot, and I didn't want to repurpose it either. It had been used in the context of very sort of narrow usage, I suppose, is, you know, around certain aspects of tourism and things like that. In New Zealand, and part of Policy 16, we have a description of what a surf break is. Now, that description is very, very physical, geophysical. And so when you talk about the management of a surf break within our management setting here in New Zealand, it's much more than just the physical component. It's so much more. You've got the social and cultural setting, historical setting, tourism, and lots of other moving parts to what that space is and how it would be managed. So surfing resource became an umbrella term for me and my associates and my co-researchers, because we needed, essentially, it was born out of necessity. We needed another term, and it's been adopted fairly well since then. I think, you know, you can appreciate there is a need for that differentiation between the physical aspects of the surfing resource, i.e. the surf break, and then all the other moving parts. So we had to sort of tease that out for a while there, and it's become quite well and regularly used now as well, outside of Aotearoa New Zealand. So that's quite cool. And then what you were speaking about in terms of the swell corridor, that's part of the surf break. And what I would say is the offshore extension, essentially, of a surf break area. And if we consider that physical setting, there's a couple of really important parts to making a surf break what it is. Not the surfing resource, because that's a whole other discussion, but the surf break. We need waves. And then we need something to break those waves. And so that's the seabed. And generally, there is quite unique configurations along our coastline that generate or result in surfable waves. And when I mean unique, I mean, you know, 0.00001% of our coastline, for example. Here it's 0.0003% of the coastline is occupied by surf breaks of national significance. And so it's those two components are super important. And the swell corridor is the area offshore where waves propagate through. And so that area is super important. If you say, go and build a wall straight across that swell corridor, then all of a sudden your waves aren't reaching your surf break anymore. If you were to put a wind farm in there, it might dice up those waves, or it could just attenuate so much energy that it doesn't break in the same way. It could alter the angle that it arrives at the coast. And so activities within the swell corridor, they're an element that need to be managed. And one of the pieces I've worked on for quite a few years, and it's been an ongoing development, is defining that swell corridor. And we look at historical wave climate, and we propagate waves through a numerical model. So that's calculating how a wave field evolves over time. We run that for over a decade of all the different wave conditions coming into a spot, and then we look back where they came from, and we use those wave rays, essentially, that go back out in a propagation in reverse, essentially back out where they came from, and we use that footprint of all of those traces of where the waves came from to establish where that swell corridor is. And then you get to the extremely dynamic part, which is wave breaking. We'll scroll back a bit there, because you have preconditioning before that as well. So we can have certain seabed features that set up the wave breaking in the near shore. And so having an understanding of what the seabed's doing within the swell corridor is super important as well. good examples of how important preconditioning can be are pipeline, the reef and near shore. Whilst there might be some sand impacts going on, the formation of the wave that really defined extremely obvious peak to most surfers, it is formed by an offshore ridge. It's not the near shore bathymetry or sea floor that's impacting the way that wave breaks. Ocean Beach, San Francisco, it's the offshore ebb tidal delta that's massive. It does some focusing of the wave, so bringing wave energy together, but it also bifurcates the wave crest, so it breaks them up and makes them cross up. Actually, I'm pretty sure there's waves in Nicaragua that do that as well. I had some friends that surfed there, and they started describing what was going on, and we looked on Google Earth, and wasn't everything really obvious, and then we found there was some offshore reefs, and it was dicing those waves up before they got anywhere near breaking, and created a longshore wave height gradients. And so where a wave is bigger, it's going to break in deeper water, and where it's smaller, it will break in shallower water. And that allows the wave to peel, even if the beach is a planar. So there's no distinguishing features. There's no channel or anything like that. When a wave comes in and it's larger, it's going to break before the smaller part. And so understanding all of those components, indeed the functional components of a surf break is something that is integral to the surfing resource manager, or at least the surf break part of it anyway.
Yeah, no, and I remember, you showed me this model of, I think it was Raglan, and you had been collecting data over the course of maybe a number of years or something, but I just found it to be fascinating. You documented essentially every time the wave broke, and I think that's what you're talking about, this swell corridor, or mapping these breaks. But would you mind explaining a little bit, I think I butchered that, so would you mind explaining a little bit more about that, how you were tracking this specific wave, and, you know, more broadly, what does your day-to-day look like as a surfing resource management specialist? I know you send me tons of pictures of the waves. So are you just surfing every day? Is that what you're doing?
I try to surf every day. It's the only exercise I do. So try to get out there. In fact, today there might be a little grovel going on. It's cold and windy and onshore, but what I showed you was a short video of footage that I'd collected, or we'd collected, from a site above Waikerie, which is Menu Bay, which is one of New Zealand's surf breaks of national significance. It's a world-class left-hand point break. It was visited by Bruce Brown and co. Back in the day in the summer, and then again in the end of summer too, and national competitions and whatnot. It's a great setup, and we have a camera up on the hill that looks down onto it, and that camera collects thousands of images every single day. It does the first 20 minutes of every hour, essentially. And then those images are stored and processed on site and sent to the cloud and things like that. And I suppose to the first part, no, that's not to do with the swell corridor. This is more to do with the immediate dynamics within the surf break area. And what we did was trained a model, a convolutional neural network, to be able to detect the breaking part of the wave and the orientation of the wave crest. And with those two components, we can work out from frame to frame what the peel angle of the wave is. Now, the peel angle is really important as a surfing wave quality parameter. And also gives an indication of, you know, the sort of skill level required by people to be able to navigate a wave. It's the angle between the breaking part of the wave, or the unbroken wave crest, and the broken part of the wave, or the path of the breaking wave. So really small PL angles, like zero, is a closeout. Everyone's familiar with that. It's a section of wave that is simultaneously broken along its length, and it's not navigable by a surfer. We can't move fast enough. The other end of the spectrum is one that's breaking at 90 degrees to itself. It's essentially just a bore of white water moving shoreward and not translating laterally, so not breaking down the line. Really good for learning to surf on. And then as that PL angle decreases, it gets faster and faster and faster. Now, if you think about sort of your average Joe, intermediate surfer, they're kind of looking for something around the 65 degree, 70 degree kind of thing. As you start moving into sort of more high performance, we're dropping down to 55s. And once you get into the 40s and less, then you're talking top pros and things like that. Although that's based on, I suppose, not old research, but it's been around a while, and I would say the performance levels have increased quite a lot since then. And so what we did with over a million images was detected those breakpoints and those crest orientations so that we could pull out the PL angle as a wave breaks its way down the point. And so we did a wave tracking algorithm that followed it, but then pulled out the PL angle as it went. And then what you get after leaving a camera on site for many years is you start to build up these patterns of wave breaking and PL angles. And that's important because what you're doing is establishing a baseline, an environmental baseline, a quantitative environmental baseline. We're saying that in this area of the surf break area, that the point break, the PL angles do this. They do it at this tide, and then under these conditions, they act and behave in this way. And why it's important to establish an environmental baseline is, A, we improve our understanding, and we cannot sustainably manage our resources if we don't understand them. And then B, we've got an environmental baseline so that, let's say, any kind of activity wanted to be undertaken within that surf break area or adjacent to that surf break area, we can say, well, yeah, that activity can go ahead, but it can't have any impact on this environmental baseline. So, probably one of the things I'm most proud of that I've achieved is working out how to get that done effectively. This is an extremely dynamic environment to be able to track environmentally. And so that model, lots of pretty colors. It tells you a little bit about, what kind of skill level you need to have, because you've got the PL angle and then those sort of skill levels associated with it. And it's tracking the breaking waves through time.
Yeah. I remember you showing it to me. I thought it was pretty, it's fascinating. It was really interesting. And, I would imagine this also allows, you or maybe even, let's say like climate scientists to track sea level rise over time too, which obviously is, certainly an important thing as we look at the coast. But, as you were talking and you're talking about the pitch angles and different, skill levels and all of that, I was thinking, so for you specifically, how do you define a good wave? Like, what do you look for in a wave specifically? And again, I know that's a very subjective question because, I may prefer a certain wave over a different wave, and you may like that other wave. And so, but, what kind of wave do you look for? I guess, what are your favorites, so to speak?
Are you asking me personally, or are you asking me as a objective surf researcher?
Maybe both. Maybe, Ed, what is your, because for me, I talk about this in other episodes, but, one of my favorites is where I did my research, in Popoyo. Yeah. It is the wave that I drew when I was a kid drawing all my notebooks, you know, in elementary school, that I was sitting in the water one day surfing it. And I was like, this is the wave I draw, or I used to draw on my notebook. So for me, that A-frame, you know, rock reef, you know, just that wave with the offshore winds, the warm water. I mean, for me, that I don't need 15 to 20 feet. I don't need Nazare. I don't need any of that. You know, just a nice 6 to 8 foot, maybe 10 foot on the sets. And just, you know, I can go right, I can go left, offshore winds. So that's me. And again, that's very much subjective. But so what is your favorite type of wave? And then I guess objectively, what is a good wave?
Yeah. So I'll surf anything. you saw that in San Diego. I'll let you go on anything.
Very, very good point. Well, I guess living in Florida, I have to surf everything too. So, but I do have my preferences.
Yeah. I'm happy as long as I get a turn in. Personally, like I guess I'm a bit of a surf rat. Like I'll just scramble around and just keep on getting waves until something good turns up. I'm not too keen on the massive stuff. I don't mind it pretty solid, but the really big stuff, I don't know. I had a couple of experiences where, you know, it was got to survive because I've got kids moment. So I kind of just probably not for me. Ultimately though, it's about big vert off the tops probably more than anything else. Like barrels are fun, but man, just slamming the lip and it slamming your back as well, bit of punch. Yeah, I don't mind if it's onshore or whatever. I don't care if the water's cold, but as long as I can get a vert turn in. Like I get tired of cutbacks, that's for sure. So yeah, a vert turn, but it only takes one, right? Like it's one.
Yeah, absolutely.
One solid turn and the session's made. I mean, that's it. Stoked and can go in. Well, I probably don't go in, but it's so, the one that you think, you go, oh, that was really worth it because I got that turn in.
It made the session for sure. Yeah, totally. I'm right there with you. I have no problem, you know, being from the East Coast of the United States, you know, you can't be but so picky. But you know, if I were to have my ideal wave, it's, you know, the one I've, you know, been surfing so much in Popoyo in Nicaragua. So, but okay, so objectively, before we get back into some of the science, or maybe this is our segue, what is an objectively good wave?
Well, to say it's a good wave is not objective, I suppose. It's
valid point.
So there's a couple of things. There's a couple of things we look at quantitatively. We've mentioned peer angle already, and I would argue that that is the single most important parameter, because you could have a barreling wave, you could have a crumbling wave, you could have a wave that's 500 meters long, or you could have a wave that's 10 meters long. But if it's not peeling, you're not surfing it. So I would say from the get-go, peel angle is probably the most important component. And I described already, you know, those sort of ranges that we're looking at. And then the next part is shape. A really good peel angle, but it's sort of flopping its way along, doesn't provide a surfer with a lot of speed. And our speed is generally generated from the steepness of the wave, especially when we start moving into performance surfing. And there's classical definitions of wave shape. We move from spilling, which is where it's feathering along, into the plunging category, where we start to get a vortex at the top of the wave. So it's folding over itself and creating an open space from the lip down. And then you move into surging and collapsing waves. And examples of those are where your Hellman are really getting busy, Shipstern's Bluff, and things like that, where you end up with steps in the face of the wave, and generally beyond the reach of your Joe Bloggs surfer. Now, the in-between category, the plunging category, and just prior to that as well, steep spilling waves are probably the waves that are most commonly surfed, because lots of us aren't getting barreled every single day. And then the category in between, the plunging category, is the one that we really, really like. So strongly plunging waves where the width of the barrel or the vortex is equal to the height. It's got a high breaking intensity. And we can measure that intensity based on the ratios between the length and the width. And that's actually was the work of my business partner, Dr. Sean Mead. That was his PhD thesis 23 years ago, looking at why these certain shapes and peel angles occur. And he was the one sort of mapping out surf breaks in detail. Guys had done it before, but he started to really understand what those functional components are. And so you've got the shape of the wave, super important. Yes, we want it to be steep. We don't want it to be surging and collapsing, because we end up with compressed vertebrae or something like that when it all goes wrong. But, you know, leave that to the Florence brothers, etc. And then you've got something that's more subjective. So I feel, you know, wedge shape and peel angle are objective, completely objective. And you can very much so establish a baseline with that. Something else you can establish a baseline is ride length, but ride length is definitely more subjective. Some people will always enjoy a super long ride, and that is what's going to get them stoked. And they can say that that's a great wave because of its length. Others may say that, you know, if it's punchy for the first 10 meters, 20 meters, 30 meters, the first few sections, and they get a bunch of turns in, but then it burgers out for the next 150, where they're only doing cutbacks or whatever, then, or not even anything, just trimming to hold the line to stay with it, then they wouldn't enjoy that so much. I guess the same could be said about a racy wave, so the peel angle's low, and the same could be said about a hollow wave. But you can establish a baseline with ride length, and we've done that through the camera work, but also through GPS tracking as well. So surfers with, you know, GPS watches, but well before that, we'd put GPS in our wetsuits or strap to your head or whatever to track the length of the rides and the speeds that you're going at. So that's sort of objectively how we look at quantifying wave quality, not what's good or a bad wave, but wave quality at a given site is essentially based on those three elements. And then you can expand a little bit more and start to look at, you know, consistency of a spot and things like that, and then conditions that are, so consistency for being able to surf or there being waves, and then consistency for high quality days as well, which gets a bit more complicated.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night, and building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy, the way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And, you know, I love how, and I want to dig more into, you know, the, you know, your involvement with the, you know, International Association of Surfing Researchers, because really all of us are, you know, analyzing certain elements, academic elements, or inquiring into things academically. But we all have this common love for surfing, you know, and I'm always fascinated in how you and your colleague, you know, Dr. Dan Reinemann, who's been on, how you guys can really bring, and Shaw, of course, you know, Dr. Shaw Mead, who hasn't been on here, but, you know, I'm obviously familiar with his work. How you guys can break this down scientifically, you know, I find it fascinating. Something that we all love, a wave, and you guys really break it down in a way that's super scientific. And, you know, so I appreciate, and I always enjoy, you know, listening to how you guys do that. And by the way, for the listeners, you know, you referred to something as a burger, and that just is a slang term for surfing that is refers to a mushy wave. You know, the other thing is kind of historically, Ed, you know, what a good, you know, you say a good wave is subjective, and it is. I mean, even historically, you know, earlier you mentioned the Endless Summer movie and what, you know, the individuals in that movie were looking for was a really Malibu style peely wave. You know, Point Break style. And now when we think of doing a surf trip, whether it's you or me or some of our colleagues and friends, we aren't necessarily looking for that, you know, kind of slow reeling Point Break. Not that we're opposed to it, but what we consider now a quote unquote good wave for a surf trip has definitely changed historically as well. And I think that has a lot to do, at least in my own view, like the modernization of the surfboard and our ability to ride things, ride waves that, you know, I won't put it in as scientific terms the way you will, but more critical, more steeper waves and things like that. And so, but I do want to come back to something you mentioned a little bit ago, and that's really, ANZ or New Zealand making a real concerted effort to protect these breaks. So your work is, you know, sort of important to the country as a whole. And I guess my question is why does New Zealand at a state level or a national level, I should say, why do they feel the need to protect surf breaks? I mean, is there an economic incentive? Like why is this such an important thing for you all over there?
So it was driven by the surfers, essentially. It was I mentioned earlier on about how there are many cases of surf break degradation or complete loss, essentially, of the resources, and that's been happening worldwide for a really, really long time. Everyone will be able to name somewhere. Every surfer will be able to name somewhere where there's been an impact and there's either been a loss of wave quality or a loss of the resource completely. And New Zealand's no exception. And I suppose the most sort of seminal moment in New Zealand's history was the construction of a marina in Whangamata. The surf break at Whangamata is a delta break. It's a bar break of the highest quality. Jerry Lopez referred to it as the jewel of the Pacific. There was a lot of opposition to the construction of a marina with inside the estuary. So this wasn't a case of plonking a pier or a marina right on top of the surf break. It was removed from the immediate surf break area, but it was inside the estuary. Now, bar breaks, delta breaks, ebb tidal deltas, they are in a unique balance of tides and wind and waves to maintain the ebb tidal delta in a certain configuration. And when you change the tidal prism of an estuary, so that's the amount, the volume of water that's going in and out, by altering the bathymetry of that the estuary, you've got a chance to change the balance between those maintaining forces. And when it was being proposed, there was a lot of opposition. There was there was marches against it. There was issues beyond the surf break itself associated with that proposal, but eventually it got in. But during that process, the surfing community in New Zealand was quite galvanized, because they could see that there could be problems associated with it. And so and look, I wasn't there at the time, but my understanding is that when the review for the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement came up in 2008, they were the surfing community submitted avidly with support from experts as well, surf science experts, to say, look, you know, these are extremely unique features of they're extremely unique natural outstanding natural features of our coastline that need proper management or protection, as you know. I sort of always sort of between, you know, which is the right term. Is it proper management, or is it protection, or does proper management lead to protection? And essentially, there was a board of inquiry to inform the development of the next iteration of the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement, which was published in 2010. And during that board of inquiry, there was lots of submissions from the surf community. And that's how the surf breaks of national significance came about. It's how there is other mentions of surf or surfing within the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement. And the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement is implemented under the Resource Management Act, and it's the only mandatory policy as well. So that's how Aotearoa New Zealand essentially ended up with a management framework that is favorable for surf breaks.
It seems very there's a lot of obviously, as you were saying, there's buy-in not only from at a national level, but surfers and others are buying into this, and it seems kind of based on what you're saying and based on things that Dr. Dan Reinemann had been and I had talked about, like, it's in the best interest really of for the community, for the coast. And that said, I did ask Dan, Dan and yourself published an article together, and Dan and I talked about local surfers as resource experts and individuals capable of observing coastal change due to climate change, erosion, etc. And I just wanted to get, since you guys do a lot of collaborating together, I was just curious to know what your thoughts were on that. And how do you think, how can they collaborate with you all as, let's say, experts or coastal management experts regarding surf resource management? So how can these, let's say, local surfers, non-scholars, non-academics, however we want to phrase that, and then you all as sort of experts in these areas, how do you see you all working together?
Yeah, I mean, it's imperative. I mean, it's going to always be the best solution. Just going back to the other point as well. In ANZ, there is more people surf than play rugby. And New Zealand, the All Blacks are world famous. And so for a country that is rugby mad, to have surfing as a sport that is undertaken more regularly than the national sport is saying quite something, you know. And so that importance, you know, recognizing that importance is essentially justified given the current statistics. In terms of leveraging local experts, I mean, I just don't think it's possible really these days to do any coastal resource management without doing that, let alone surf breaks. I mean, it's the information you can gain by just engaging with local experts, whether that be on an individual basis or at stakeholder meetings. What often happens is you will find something that no one knew at all because no one's got memory for it. So some of our, you know, older statespersons just giving these jewels of information that just, you know, and then the penny drops about maybe a coastal process or just a missing link in why things are happening. You know, that's an absolute gold outcome. And what often happens is that you get these anecdotal inputs that you tie together with the more sort of technical tools, you know, that's numerical modeling or analysis of large data sets or, you know, historical wave climate. You start to tie these anecdotal pieces in together with this really technical approach, and you're validating each other essentially. And so that's a really important component. It helps us build a really good picture of the environment that we're trying to understand. And like I said earlier, we can't effectively or sustainably manage an environment that we don't understand. And so bringing those tools together is really important. There's an element of having to moderate local expert input because sometimes, let's face it, it's way off the mark, but so is some of the numerical modeling that I've seen. And so validating each other is really important, filtering through what's sort of real and perceived is super important. But probably the most important part is that it's their environment, it's their local community that should be driving it, because they're the ones that have to live in it. And so they should be driving the decision making as well. So being informed and part of the process is something that hasn't been done traditionally, but it's super important for all coastal management. And then in terms of surfing resources, well, you can't avoid it anyway, because every local surfer is a complete expert, whether you tell them they are or not. All surfers are apprentice coastal oceanographers, meteorologists, sediment dynamicists. I mean, like, they're literally just like, they have this whole science thing going on the whole time. Many people have written about this, you know, how we just sort of pick up because we immerse ourselves in our environment. And let's face it, your process, if you're a consultant, an environmental consultant coming in, your process is going to be a hell of a lot harder, both in terms of knowledge, but in terms of just working with a community, if you don't get buy-in from them, if you don't listen to them and you don't engage with them and take on board the things that they're willing to share. It can go the other way as well, where it's actually quite hard to get information out of people because surfers, they don't like talking about their surf breaks sometimes. It can go the other way, you know. So working with local knowledge holders really is the way forward in terms of coastal management, but especially in surfing resource management.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I really appreciate, you know, the way you and Dan really frame it is that, you know, collaboration is essential. And I would say, you know, I'm not, you know, obviously not in you guys' field. I'm a historian, but you know, I wouldn't be able to write the things I've written, you know, whether it's for my PhD or whatever, without the help of these local individuals who know, you know, whether it's through oral histories or whatever. And so, you know, you really raise an awesome point in terms of how vital it is to rely, maybe not too heavily, as you said, because, you know, there's sometimes the way they perceive the past isn't always what it was. But I think that's our job as academics to sort of, you know, hold that, what they're saying, you know, test it, let's say. But I do believe, I completely agree with you, just that collaboration, at least I would not have been able to have the success I had in writing my dissertation had it not been for that sort of collaboration, the trust. And I'm sure many of our listeners get, you know, perhaps get tired of hearing me say that. I feel like I say this in every episode, but, you know, I think that's an amazing point you make. And, you know, I speaking of all of us and all of our, all the amazing research, you know, many of our, you and many of our colleagues are doing around the world. You know, I'd like to know a little bit more about not only the Aotearoa New Zealand Association for Surfing Research, but I'd like to hear, and I'd really love for you to share with our listeners more about the International Association of Surfing Researchers so that people can get a sense of what we're all doing around the world. And maybe, you know, how someone can get involved with it.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, I'll start with the ANZASR. That was essentially the a later realized outcome of a 3-year government-funded research project that we did to develop the management guidelines for surfing resources. And during that time, we established cameras to monitor a number of breaks across the country, and really put a lot of local knowledge and expert knowledge and tools in place through that period. And at the end of it, rather than just kind of going, oh, that's finished, we wanted something to sort of continue that work and be an owner of the guideline. It's only a very small entity, but we're looking this year to revisit the guidelines. So they were published in 2019, and then I did a small update earlier this year. We want to revisit the guidelines this year as the trust, pull in a number of experts across New Zealand again, and go, oh, all right, so what have we learned? How useful have the guidelines be? How can we improve them and things like that? So essentially that small trust, it's a charitable trust here in New Zealand, is responsible for trying to keep New Zealand, Aotearoa New Zealand, as one of the front runners in terms of surf science and surfing resource management. It's a really useful entity. It's a you know, passion project, essentially. It's like a very mini version, I suppose, of the International Association for Surfing Research. Now, that concept that's been around for a very, very long time, that concept, not under that name, but the idea of bringing surf researchers together, it has very much so been sort of banded around in different formats. I suppose more isolated in terms of the different disciplines than what we had in mind. This contemporary manifestation of this is essentially the product of me going to a global wave conference in Cornwall and meeting Dan Reinemann and Jess Ponting, both doctors, I think both professors, I should say, sorry, and sitting around a table and having a few glasses of wine and getting excited about the idea of an entity that brings people's efforts together. For me personally, the idea of not reinventing the wheel, which I've seen many times, was a big driver. But ultimately, some of the best research you'll ever see is out of interdisciplinary work. So bridging those gaps that are often a function of a historical disconnect, but also just being removed globally. So we wanted to sort of bring everyone together into a common forum. Now, it's been a long sort of road with like 5 years or 6 years sort of trying to egg this thing along. We've held a few events on the back of other events, I suppose, bigger events where we're like, oh, look, there's a bunch of researchers. Let's kind of say, let's have a meeting and try and figure out, you know, what does this look like for us? Now, you know, we've been extremely democratic about the way we've gone about it, in that we're not saying, right, we're doing this and everyone's going to follow us. It's like we keep on going back to our surf research community and saying, look, is this going to work? What would it look like? How would it benefit us? And each time we've evolved it a little bit more. And now this year we're kind of ready to launch. This is, I suppose, a shameless promotion, but we're ready to launch a new website with a membership platform, essentially, where, you know, the costs will cover the administration for us all to have essentially a surf research focused presence, where we can start building those relationships, building connections, making collaborations, sharing our research, being able to find tutors and things like that. And that's kind of the whole idea to the platform. We've got a bit of a way to go, you know, but we've also got some really good we've got some good background behind it. You know, the vision is a global community connected to share ideas, stimulate creativity, and to collaborate and enhance our collective knowledge of surfing. So there's a bit to do, but it's something that I get really excited about. Again, a passion project, but we've got a great committee. We sort of reached out to everyone that we knew, about 150, 200 people sort of on this email list, and just said, hey, look, you know, we really want to push this to the next level. Can we have sort of some nominations for people to go on a committee? So we've got a small committee, and look, you know, everyone's doing it on top of their day jobs, I suppose. And we're getting there, but it's something that I can, you know, I think everyone involved can get really excited about. Every time we've presented it to a larger surf research group, they're all like, this sounds awesome, let, you know, sign me up, you know, when's the journal gonna start, sort of, you know, when's the next which conference are we going to piggyback next, and things like that. So it's something that we're really looking forward to sort of getting things like this, like promoting the podcast and things like that through that forum is it'll be really good. It'll be really helpful to people. You imagine how many undergrads have just struggled to get going because there's no resources, because surf research is frowned upon in some institutes. It's not considered a worthy discipline to pursue. And so being able to support those to give credence to their research is something that we want to achieve.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I'm obviously, you know, grateful to be part of this broader or global cohort of surfing researchers. And, you know, I being part of that listserv, you know, I always I was able to reach out to a lot of people that have come on the podcast because of it. And, you know, just for the listeners, just so you know, in the footer of surfinghistorian.com under useful links, we do have the Center for Surfing Research, which is kind of hubbed, home based at San Diego State University. But, you know, Ed, once your new website launches, you know, we're going to have it on there as well. And make sure, you know, like you said, make surf research accessible to this new generation of surfing researchers, because it is an emerging field. And I think current undergrads really are going to, you know, perhaps take over and be on the front lines of taking this, you know, this, this interdisciplinary field to a new, to another level. And, you know, Ed, I, you know, like I said, I'm super stoked, super grateful to finally get you on. You know, I know it's the evening for me, so it's another day for you over in New Zealand, but, you know, I want to just go ahead and give you the last word. And, you know, before you start, I want to say thank you again, for making time for this. And, again, with that said, you have the last word.
Well, no, thanks, Jason. I've been looking forward to getting on here and sharing some of the things that we've been doing over here. And you know, that last part as well, about the IASR, I think, you know, it's bigger picture stuff. Surf research needs our cooperation, and all those different groups, the Coastal Engineers Institute for Women Surfers, the Center for Surf Research, the Plymouth Institute, there's guys in Portugal that have got lots of little groups has been there, and we just want to bring it all together. And that includes, you know, the guys like me who deal with environmental science, and the guys like you who give us a historical perspective. So thanks for having me, and we'll keep pushing forward.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Ed about his research on surfing resource management, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by French sociologist Jeremy Lemarie. Jeremy and I will be chatting about his research on surf tourism, marketing surfing, surfer activism, and solidarity within the global surf community. If these topics seem interesting to you, then this will no doubt be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Face Stuff again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at face-stuff.com. And while you're there, use promo code STOKED15 for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.